Hey there, welcome to another edition of Livewire. I'm Luke Burbank. We are going to the movies this week because that is a thing that we can do again. The first time that I get to go back to a real movie theater, I'm not even going to be mad if people talk during the previews. That is how much the pandemic has changed all of us. First up, we're going to talk to our friend, the writer Lindy West. She's got a hilarious book out of film reviews. Plus, Kirsten Johnson is going to stop by to talk about her documentary, Dick Johnson is Dead, which explores the impending death of her father, but in a surprisingly upbeat way. Then we're going to hear some music from Layla McCalla, who wrote an entire album inspired by the poetry of Langston Hughes, which is really, really good. The poetry, obviously, but also the album. So get the popcorn popping, throw on your comfy sweats, and settle in for another episode of Livewire, which starts right after this.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of Livewire is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving or cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey, Elena.
Hi, Luke. How's it going?
You sound relaxed.
I am. Do you want to know why?
Yeah.
Because this is my first Zoom meeting in 100 hours. I have gone over 4 full days without logging onto Zoom, and I am so zen. Mm-hmm. I'm just like chilling like Bob Dylan on penicillin.
That's got to be the longest kind of Zoom-free time for you in a while, right?
Yeah, maybe, you know, over a dozen months. And hallelujah. I mean, I have like 6 Zoom things for the rest of the week. So,
but we're catching you at the right time for this
right.
recording of our radio show because you're just in exactly the right place. Molly, are we recording this thing?
Heck fire. Yeah, we're recording.
All right. Take it away, Elena.
From PRX, it's Livewire. This week, writer Lindy West, filmmaker Kirsten Johnson, with music from Layla McCalla. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello, and now, the host of Livewire, Luke Burbank!
Thank you so much, Elena Passarello. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the show this week, which is going to be a fun one. We're going to the movies, which is something that I think we've all missed. Some of us more than we would have expected. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the movie theater was a big part of my life and of entertaining myself. So we're going to get a little bit of that back this week on the show. We also, of course, asked the Livewire listeners a question. We asked, what movie have you seen the most times and why? And we're going to hear folks' response to that question coming up in a few minutes. First, though, of course, we got to kick things off with the best news we heard all week. This, of course, is our little reminder to ourselves and everyone that there is good news happening out there in the world. Elena, what is the best news that you heard all week?
Well, once again, it's animal news, of course, because it's me. And because animal stories just make us feel good.
Yeah, they do.
My story has to do with crows.
Okay.
Canadian crows, to be specific.
Okay.
This is a crow named River who was rescued by Canada's 7-time log rolling champion, a guy named Daryl Hudson, who has a lumberjack park in Nova Scotia. And
that's exactly where I expected the lumberjack park to be, by the way.
In Nova Scotia.
Yeah, that all seems to check out.
Yeah, and of course, you know, like he got this crow, he rescued this crow because he cut down a tree and a bunch of baby crows fell out.
Aww.
And so he rehabbed them, one of whom decided that he wanted to join his foster father in the fine art of log rolling. And so very slowly, Daryl Hudson taught River the Crow how to, you know, run on a log so that it rolls while submerged in a pool of water. And it's the cutest thing, the video that you've ever seen. And the crow seems really into it and also kind of bad at it. Like he keeps falling in the water, but he doesn't care. Like he just jumps back in. And the reporter, the interviewer, was asking Daryl Hudson, you know, like, how did you get him? How did you convince him to do it? And apparently he just did it because he wanted to. He just saw Daryl Hudson.
Just love of the game.
Yeah, love of the game. And now he's like, I want to try it too. They also canoe together.
I feel like a bird would have a little bit of a competitive advantage because of the fact that, you know, they can levitate effectively. Mm-hmm.
Well, Hudson does say that he cheats, quote unquote, because he has more grippier feet than humans do, right? Like he's got those claws that can actually sort of get more purchase on the log as it moves. So he probably would be disqualified from any of Canada's fine lumberjack arts.
Also, you have to find another crow in the division to compete against, which is that's going to be a whole hassle. Well, speaking of games, my best news that I heard this week is also involving something you use in a sport. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is the best news or just the kind of oddest news that I heard this week. A guy in Michigan, outside of Detroit somewhere, his name's David Olson. Mm-hmm. He had this problem with his back steps at his house, which was that he was getting flooding in his house. Mm-hmm. And a contractor came out and said, well, the problem is your concrete slab is sloping towards your door. Any homeowner knows this is like the nightmare scenario.
Right.
So he went out there with a sledgehammer to break this thing up. And as he was doing so, he started to find bowling balls buried underneath these back steps. At first, he found like 50.
What?
And then he just kept digging. He found a bunch more. He at last count had 160 Brunswick bowling balls buried underneath the back steps of his house.
Excuse me?
He couldn't figure out what was going on, so he posted it on Facebook, and it turns out there used to be a Brunswick factory in Muskegon, Michigan, where the employees were allowed to take home defective bowling balls and use them for like construction purposes if they wanted to. And so the thought is, all of these bowling balls, by the way, he says there's probably hundreds more like under his grass. He's just not going to dig it all up because they're just kind of fine down there. So some Brunswick bowling employee must have lived in this home and brought home all these bowling balls just to fill in the sand and dirt under these steps.
Oh.
I think the most interesting part of the story, though, is a mere footnote at the end of the piece. And I feel like this, for me, would be what the whole story would be about were I writing this. They're talking about what he's doing with the bowling balls. He's giving some to his stepfather, who's going to use them as custom furniture legs. He's also going to use some of the bowling balls for edging around his landscaping and to make sculptures. And then they just mentioned casually, he also donated 8 balls to a nearby church to use in their bowling ball cannon at the pig roast.
Their what?
Their bowling ball cannon. That they bring out for the pig roast.
I think Muskegon is like right on Lake Michigan. So I'm imagining they're shooting the cannon out into the lake. So
I'm not even going to lie. I've never wanted to go to a church pig roast in Michigan more than this one. Now that I find out that they have a bowling ball cannon. So that is the best news that I heard all week. This is LiveWire. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Elena Passarello. Let's get our first guest on over to the show. She is known for a whole bunch of different things. She created the TV show Shrill, which is based on a memoir that she wrote of the same name. She's a New York Times opinion writer. She actually got her start, though, writing film reviews at the Seattle alt weekly, The Stranger. And her new book, Bleep, actually, we can't say the first word of the title on public radio, revisits some beloved movies from the last 40 years and some of her really withering and funny reviews of those films. Lindy West is also a longtime friend of the show. Lindy, welcome back to LiveWire.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book is really, really funny. And I don't know if a lot of people maybe know that you kind of started out writing about films at The Stranger. And I don't know if we've talked about this on LiveWire before, you and I, but I have this really vivid memory of you and I being on Capitol Hill in Seattle eating some pizza when your Sex and the City 2 review got like retweeted by Roger Ebert, I think. And your phone was going off like a slot machine. It was crazy. Was that almost like a, I don't want to overstate it, but was that like a game, kind of game-changing moment for your writing career?
Oh, definitely. Like, I had never experienced anything like that before. It was a simpler time when I had my phone set to make a noise every time someone interacted with me. Like, you know,
yeah.
And I just remember being up all night. My phone was like, ding, ding, ding. Because, you know, it got like, I don't know, 10,000 retweets or something, which was just like an unfathomable number to me. And definitely the first time like a famous person paid attention to me. And it was Roger Ebert, which is so heartwarming.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, totally a some small turning point in my life for sure.
Now that you're the new Roger Ebert, what would you consider your approach to film criticism to be?
Well, I mean, I'm just a buffoon, sir. Like, you know, we can say that I started my career as a film critic, and that's technically true. But I was absolutely not qualified and did many disservices to the film community. But my approach has not changed. I've learned nothing. I still, 15 years later, I like to just be mean and exploit the job to just make my own jokes and try to make myself look funny.
And was that kind of like, how did this book come about? I know it's some things that you had written previously and then some new stuff that you went and did. But was, I mean, were you looking to get back to writing about something that is absolutely unimportant to the world?
Yeah, exactly. No, I wrote two really like heavy books. Like I wrote like a depressing memoir and then an extra depressing book about politics. And like, technically, I think both of those books are also funny, but it was just like a lot, you know, it was just a heavy couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what could I write that would have just the least value and like, what's the most inconsequential, like lowest stakes thing that I could write? And these sort of rewatches of old movies that I started doing at Jezebel, I started with Love Actually, mm-hmm. which became really popular. And people still send that article around like every mm-hmm. Christmas, like a new holiday tradition, which touches my heart. And I was like, I feel like people would buy a book of that. That's probably my most successful piece of writing of all time. And it has millions of views at this point. And every year it goes viral again. So I was like, okay, what if I did a whole book of that? It would be fun. I wouldn't have to talk about my feelings or like cry or whatever. I could just do like butt jokes. I could be the real me.
No. The real Lindy West is who we're talking to right now on the LiveWire House Party. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. Lindy's new book is actually named sort of For Love Actually, but instead it's like, we'll just say Bleep Actually. But let's talk about Love Actually a little bit, about your essay about it. You were not really a fan, or at least you're pointing out some of the less great elements of this like very, very treasured holiday kind of rom-com. What are some of your issues with that film?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, people like to call me like a noted Love Actually hater. like this is something important to me.
The foreground of the counter Love Actually movement. Right.
Like
the counterinsurgents.
Yeah, right. I don't care. I don't care about it. People can like it if they want. I just think that it feels very manufactured. Mm-hmm. It feels very much sort of like created in a lab by men to delight women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then it also, it's just reinforces like every kind of toxic relationship that was really romanticized and normalized in the 90s and early 2000s. And I don't know, I'm just like, I don't want it. I don't need it. Like, I don't like it when men are like, here, we made this thing for you. No, thank you. Why don't you ask me what I like? I don't like this. Yeah. I mean, do you want more specifics?
No, I think that's actually great. Also, we're due for a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about one of the films, maybe the only film that actually gets a positive review. in your words, it's the only good movie. So, I'm trying to get people to stay through the break. So let's do that. Let's take a quick break. This is the Livewire House Party. We are talking to Lindy West, author of Shrill, The Witches Are Coming, and now Bleep, actually the definitive 100% objective guide to modern cinema. Stay with us. We will be right back. Welcome back to Livewire from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We are talking to Lindy West about her latest book, Bleep, actually, the definitive 100% objective guide to modern cinema, where she writes about a lot of movies that have some shortcomings. And then one movie that you really love, apparently, which is The Fugitive. You say it's the only good movie. Why are you so pro The Fugitive?
It's just perfect. What's wrong with it? Name one thing, Luke.
I'm trying to run through the whole movie, which I saw at the Crest Cinema in Seattle
$2.
When I was like 12. So this is going back for me a ways. But I think it's a good movie. But I'm curious that it's the one movie that you bestow all your love upon in this book.
Well, I mean, that's kind of just a bit that I'm doing, but
all right.
Also, it is perfect. Harrison Ford is the perfect movie star. I love him so much. I love him more than my family. I like Tommy. I like their interplay. It's exciting, but it's not scary. Mm-hmm. It keeps things moving. There's a murder mystery. It's a procedural. You know, he didn't kill his wife.
That's always good.
Yeah, Chicago. And then everything works out.
One thing that you bring up that I think is really, I didn't think about it, but I totally agree with you. The last like 20 minutes are a chase scene, but there's no CGI. So it was kind of crotchety, but like, remember when chase scenes were just like people, I think you say like people getting hit in the actual head with steel beams. Like, I totally understand what that feels like. Like back in the day, to not have it be like some kind of like computer generated semi truck, but it's just running and hiding.
I know. Yeah, like running and hiding, like a normal man running. Like there's this part where it's like, oh no, he went up the stairs.
Yeah. Now we have to go up those stairs.
Yeah. And it truly is like on a human level, more, at least to me, it's like more exciting and more affecting than, you know, Transformers or whatever, where just a computer drew it.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Before the pandemic, I was at the Hoover Dam. And I was trying to analyze every kind of drain spout to see, could I jump out of that fugitive style if I had to? And the answer is no, by the way. But that has forever changed my perception of jumping out of one of those things if I absolutely had to.
I know. I feel like I have this perception that, like, you could kind of jump off anything as long as, like, there's water at the bottom. Like,
right.
If you like make your body into a pencil, you just like shoot right in, right? It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the Livewire House Party. We're talking to Lindy West about her latest book, which is Bleep, actually, the definitive 100% objective guide to modern cinema, where she writes about a bunch of different films. In case we haven't chased off like the last three public radio listeners that we had, can we talk about Harry Potter, or as you call it, Harry Plot Hole?
Absolutely. Absolutely,
what's,
Luke.
What's the problem there?
Just nothing makes any sense. It's bad. It's bad and nothing makes sense. Where do you start with Harry Plot Hole? What's not a plot hole in Harry Potter?
Well, you're also a fan, though. You write, you describe yourself as a so-so Harry Potter freak. So, like, you have an understanding of the films, I guess. What is it that doesn't add up for you?
I don't know. I mean, okay, here's a fundamental issue with Harry Potter. Like, everyone's name is their job. Like, the plant teacher is named Professor Sprout. Now, did she change her name to Professor Sprout? Right. And, like, Harry Potter is just, like, absolutely chock full of that kind of thing.
Right. Right.
And the train runs on steam, even though it's magical. And the Hogwarts Express only runs once a year.
Yeah. Is this worth the infrastructure investment? Who laid the tracks? House elves? The wizard economy? Who pays the witch that runs the snack trolley on the Hogwarts Express once a year? Does she get a full salary to keep her alive, to pay her wizard rent to her wizard landlord?
I think it's now become very clear to the LiveWire listeners, Lindy, that you are the only true voice of film criticism in these chaotic times. And so we feel really lucky to have you here because we wanted you to help us play a little round of a cinematic would you rather. Okay. And these are would you rathers that are set in the world of film, and they're all referencing films that you talk about in your new book, Bleep, Actually, the Definitive 100% Objective Guide to Modern Cinema. So do you care to take a swipe at this?
I'm ready.
Okay. Lindy West, would you rather date the literal vampire Edward Cullen from Twilight or the emotional vampire that Ethan Hawke plays in the movie Reality Bites?
You always got to go with the literal vampire over the emotional vampire, for sure. Although, arguably, Edward is also an emotional vampire.
True.
So, you know, maybe might as well go with Troy, and then you could have, like, a husband who, like, eats food and sleeps and doesn't, like, massacre animals in the night.
One of our producers pointed out that, you know, the movie is called Reality Bites, and it does feature an emotional vampire.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Think about that. Yeah. All right. How about this, Lindy? Would you rather live in a theme park full of actual live dinosaurs or a house in which your father operates an electromagnetic shrinking machine with, like, zero safety precautions?
Okay. Is Jurassic Park up and running where the dinosaurs are contained, or are they running wild? Mm.
The dinosaurs are contained when you start living there, but what happens, we don't know. Much like the shrinking machine is also supposedly, you know, put away and safe, but also who knows?
So I think a lot about the part in Jurassic Park when they go into the kitchen and there's, like, flans and cakes and turkey legs everywhere. Uh-huh. And I feel lured by that. Mm. Do I get to have the Jurassic Park chef?
Mm. Yes, absolutely.
Great. Then I choose the park.
Also, like, Jeff Goldblum is there, right?
Yeah.
Like, I say this with peace and love to Rick Moranis, but it's like, come on. We're going to hang out with Jeff Goldblum or Rick Moranis?
Yeah, I can live in, like, a suburban house with a nerd.
Or you could live in Jurassic Park with a hot nerd. I think those are your options.
Yeah. I think we know the answer.
Ooh. Okay, so we're putting you down for Jurassic Park. How about this, Lindy West? Would you rather be stuck in the bus from Speed or on the door that Kate Winslet is sitting on after the Titanic sinks?
I don't know what kind of freak would say door. Why would you pick that when you could be on a bus with all your friends and Keanu and Sandy B? Like, I understand that Kate Winslet survives the sinking of the Titanic, but it's way closer to certain death than the bus with the bomb on it and Keanu Reeves. And like, the bus is more of a party, I feel like.
Yeah, they really bond together to try to overcome this obstacle. Whereas, I mean, presumably the conversation with Kate would be, wasn't there also room for Jack up here?
Yeah.
Right? I feel like the internet has done some sort of, like, sleuthing where they've tried to figure out the, like, surface area of that piece of wood. And it's been decided that, like, that could have probably held two people.
Yeah, there's, like, a Mythbusters episode or something, probably.
There's definitely a Mythbusters. All right, well, Lindy, this new book is so much fun to read. And again, I'm so happy that you got to write something that was, A, really in your wheelhouse, and B, like, not just so just sort of churning your personal experience out in a way that I'm sure is, it can be tiring at times. Although I hope you also get back to that, because those books are really good as well.
Thank you so much. So great to see you.
That was Lindy West right here on LiveWire. Her new book is Stuff, Actually, the Definitive 100% Objective Guide to Modern Cinema. Except the first word of the title is actually something different. Let's not get hung up on that. Hey, special thanks this episode to Heidi Sobel of Portland, Oregon. Heidi is part of the LiveWire member community and generously supports our show with a donation each month, which we are very thankful for because it's how we are able to keep doing LiveWire. So a big thanks this week to Heidi. This is LiveWire. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Elena Passarello. We're talking about movies this week. And so our listener question kind of centers around that. We asked the LiveWire listeners, what movie have you seen the most and why? Folks sent in those answers via social media. Elena, you have been collecting them up. What are you seeing?
Here's one from Carol. Carol has seen The Shawshank Redemption, hashtag epic justice, more than any other film. And I have a theory about Shawshank. I feel like it is the most watchable movie because it's the most perfectly structured. You start watching it and you just want to see how it ends, even though you already know how it's going to end, because you just want that narrative resolve, you know?
Yeah, and it is just, it's accessible because mm-hmm. the people who have been doing the bad stuff get their comeuppance,
mm-hmm.
and the people who you've been rooting for are sanding a boat mm-hmm. on a beach in Zihuatanejo. It's just so rewarding. There's no gray area at the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that movie so much. Okay, what are some other movies that the listeners have watched many, many times?
Here's one from Trudy, who has seen Titanic more than any other film, quote, because of all the attention to ship's details.
Oh.
Who knew? It's sort of like reading Playboy for the articles, you know?
Uh-huh.
Not for the epic love story.
Right, like this is a person who's a fan of nautical decorating.
Yeah.
They're like, really great work with that porthole.
That's right.
On
those
the steerage
starboard door side.
Knobs. That's right.
I did hear, though, that they did, like, the china patterns are perfect, mm-hmm. and all of the light fixtures are, like, historically accurate. Other than that door, I think everything really fact-checks quite well.
All right, can we get one more quick one here before we get to our next guest?
Here's one from Jennifer. Jennifer has seen a billion times the movie Moonstruck, which I think has one of the best last lines in cinema history.
Okay.
The grandfather just goes, I'm so confused. And then the movie's over.
That's how we should end more episodes of LiveWire. I feel like that's a real, you're really punting on having a kind of a moment of resolution there, right?
Yeah, it's like, why end things on a full note? But another great ending is Tombstone. Tom Mix wept. Do you remember that one? I love that one. It's like Jesus wept, you know, it's like a sentence.
Yeah. All right, speaking of films, our next guest is a very sought-after cinematographer who shot the Oscar award-winning film Citizen Four. Then she moved in front of the camera with her film Camera Person, which was incredible and got rave reviews. Now she's back with a new project, which actually features her and her father. It's called Dick Johnson is Dead. It's kind of unlike any other film I've ever seen. It's a film that they kind of made together to try to come to terms with his death and his dementia. It's really funny. It's really moving. Somehow it kind of has a surprise ending.
Yeah.
Which was unexpected. Kirsten Johnson, welcome to the show.
Hi, Luke. I'm happy to be here.
This is an incredible film that goes in all kinds of directions that I wasn't expecting it to as the viewer. I'm just wondering, starting from the very beginning, how did you pitch your dad on the idea for this movie?
I said to my dad, I'm thinking maybe we could make a movie with you where we kill you over and over using stunt people until you really die, for real.
That was the actual conversation.
That was the actual conversation. And he was like, I don't know why anyone would want to watch a movie like that, but I'd love to do it.
Was that some kind of catharsis or pre-processing for you, trying to grapple with the idea of your dad's death by sort of enacting it in multiple ways?
Yeah, well, you know, my mom had Alzheimer's and my dad and I went through it together and it's brutal, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that we had like a lucky version of it. Mm-hmm. My mother stayed kind and nice and didn't get mean and cantankerous. And even still, it just, you know, the waves of anticipatory grief are so profound where you just like, you think you've lost everything you can lose. And then boom, you lose something else of their personality. So I think that Dad and I, having lived through that, we knew what that looked like. It scared us. And both of us just wondered, is there any way to face this differently?
Did it take away some of the fear around his death too? Because you could have done a lot of things with your dad to kind of document his life. And you went with like crushed by air conditioning unit, you know?
Yes, I did. I also went with, you know, do a funeral in which all of his friends show up, mm-hmm. And get to hug him afterwards. Mm-hmm. I also went with something that would expand our capacity to do things together. And so the film just gave us opportunities neither of us ever dreamed of. Mm. And even to this day, you know, like yesterday, I got an email from a lawyer in Seattle who had seen the film not knowing it was my dad. And he'd worked with my dad for 30 years. And he just was staggered by the film and then wrote me this extraordinary letter about who my dad was as a professional. Oh. Things that I didn't know about my father. So it was almost like, you know, it brings back to life parts of him that I never knew about.
Wow. I mean, that one of the most kind of amazing moments in the film is this funeral that you staged. So your dad's still alive, but you get together what I presume are most of the Seventh-day Adventists in Seattle to kind of like eulogize him. And man, the emotion is real in that room.
Yeah.
Like the people talking about your father and talking about difficult things about his memory loss because he was beginning to suffer from that. That was an intense, intense thing. How did you get all of those people in that room? Like, what did you tell them this was?
Yeah, well, I told them exactly what I thought it would be, you know, that we would film it for a movie, but that we were all already grieving the idea of Dad's disappearance. And, you know, the only thing I asked of them was to speak in the past tense. Mm. My brother refused to do that. But, you know, what I think is so interesting about this and about life in general is we all have these colossal blind spots and we can't know things until we know them. So, you know, we can't know what it's like to be 90 years old until we're 90 years old. Mm-hmm. We can't know what it's like to lose a parent until we've lost a parent. And so with all of these people at the church who have known our family, you know, for decades and decades and who were at my mother's funeral, some of them I talked extensively on the phone about it because they were uncomfortable about it. They had questions. Mm-hmm. Others, you know, I simply wrote a letter of invitation explaining everything. And they're like, I can't wait to be there. And, you know, there's some people who dressed up, who wore crazy outfits. Like there are all kinds of things that people did, but they really responded with a desire to be there. But I would say Ray DiMaggio, my dad's best friend, who was 91 at the time, he went there.
Yeah.
He went to the most profound emotional place on behalf of all of us, I would say.
You must have to open yourself up as a filmmaker for lots of surprises when you're asking people like from your father to the congregants to do something. You can't control so much.
I'm not trying to control anything, Elena. You know, like, I mean, I think that's the thing that a life of documentary camera work has taught me, that sort of the most powerful experiences I've had have just been these like wildly unexpected things. You know, in the film I made, Camera Person, there's this moment where we're with this Bosnian grandmother and we're sort of pressing her to talk about the genocide and she really didn't want to. And you know, I kind of couldn't stand it at a certain point because one gets tired of only portraying people as victimized or as victims. Mm-hmm. So I said to her, let me just interrupt this for a second. Have you always had such a great sense of style? And she was just like, yes, you know, finally something that I really want to talk about. And she proceeded to, you know, go wild telling us about her fashion sense. And that's what I love about filming documentaries is that you always encounter these sort of profoundly unexpected things about life. And so in thinking about this film, I said, you know, dementia is unexpected. Death is unexpected. How do we use the tools of cinema language to keep mining the ways the unexpected surprises us?
Yeah.
This is Livewire Radio. We're talking to Kirsten Johnson. Her film Dick Johnson is Dead is on Netflix right now. It is a documentary about her father's sort of elderly years, their relationship. It takes a pretty unconventional approach to investigating that stuff. You're talking about trying to get information out of people when you're interviewing them. I'm wondering, like, there's this one scene where your dad's really cold on a street corner. It looks like he's kind of hitting his limit. You guys are filming a scene where he would be sort of killed on the street by like a random accident where somebody swings around with a piece of lumber on their shoulder.
And happens he's gonna, all the time.
He's going to bleed out. And I was just kind of thinking about how, you know, in this, you're his daughter and you're also a filmmaker. Was it a challenge for you to remember which one you were in specific moments?
You know, I think sometimes you can be both. Sometimes you're trying to be both and you're overpowered by the emotion and you have to stop being one or the other. And those kinds of things are unpredictable, which I also find interesting. And that's why we had sort of a setup of having behind the scenes cameras filming what was happening, because both my father with dementia and me as the daughter of my father with dementia trying to make a movie about him, like, totally unpredictable how any of us are going to respond. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could have said, whoa, we got to stop doing this scene because my dad's upset. And then there would have been a conversation with the producers and that would have been filmed. So we sort of built into the process a documentation of our questioning mm-hmm. of the process. Mm-hmm.
Was that at some point kind of exhausting? Like, did you, were you very relieved when you could just be in your apartment with your dad with the door closed and there wasn't like four layers of filmmaking going on? That just seems kind of exhausting.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, honestly, we didn't film that much for this movie. Mm. I'm not a camera person who likes to film all the time in my own life, even though that's surprising to hear. So I was very discreet about the moments where I brought the camera into our lives. I don't want to be a person who's filming other people all the time. I want to be a person who's in relationships with people, and sometimes the camera is a part of it. And, you know, the experience I've had as a documentary filmmaker is, you know, you're there with a camera when something's happening that has stakes. So us leaving our family home that we've lived in for 50 years in Bozarts Village, I'm going to have a camera there. Mm. But I don't know where me or my dad is going emotionally in that moment, but I knew something was going to happen, mm. right?
And your dad was a psychiatrist?
That's correct.
Does that play into, I mean, I'm as a viewer trying to understand how much of Dick Johnson is because of psychiatric training and how much is just his natural way of being. Mm. There's this very powerful moment where you're talking about selling his car. And it's just to watch a human being work through loss and grief in a moment, but sort of keep their equanimity. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, I feel emotional even talking about mm-hmm. it. Is that just your dad, or is that because he was a psychiatrist and he turned his brain into that kind of a machine?
You know, I think equanimity is such a beautiful choice of words, Luke. You know, even yesterday I talked to him in the dementia care facility and he said, you know what? It's crazy, but I'm kind of enjoying myself. Huh. Mm. You know, he has these layers of self-awareness. And, you know, he's often said to me, oh, wow, I really feel for you, like having to watch me lose my mind.
Wow. Well, because you mentioned the fact that your dad is actually alive still. Has your dad seen the film? What does he make of it?
Oh, my dad's seen the film hundreds of times. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of amazing thing about dementia, right? That you can sort of encounter and re-encounter things and have them be completely mm-hmm. fresh for you. So dad was incredibly useful during the edit process because he'd see a scene as if for the first time and then could give us commentary about it and say, like, this isn't funny enough, or really? Like, I don't get what's happening here. So that then we would re-edit, you know, in some ways, taking his response into account, and certainly the scene with Marta Bida, the wonderful caregiver, she and I and dad were watching the film, and then a conversation started happening, and then I got out the camera and filmed her. And then we cut that into the film. So this sort of process of the film as a back and forth between all of the people who were involved in the relationships was the way we conceived it, both in terms of the team of people who made it and the people in front of the camera.
Wow.
And what sort of response have you gotten from people who've watched the film? Does it tend to drive people towards just really wanting to hug their loved ones, particularly people who are getting older? Like, what's the takeaway from the film for people?
Well, you may be aware, Luke, but we're in a global pandemic right now.
I've heard something about it.
So I think we are all grappling with the idea of the uncertain in a way we didn't before. And, you know, it may be that we haven't seen our parents in months and months, but now when the pandemic says to us, you cannot see them, everyone has to grapple with conversations they have or hadn't had yet, right? And so I think for me, you know, I didn't see this pandemic coming either, even though we were focused on the idea of the unexpected throughout the making of this film. So I think it lands in a context where all of us are feeling new capacities to face things that we were afraid of facing. New urgencies, new questions. And, you know, one of the responses I get from people is like, yes, I'm going to call someone immediately after seeing this film. But also that I, you know, people are saying I might consider making something with someone. Like, what can we make together? You know, you hear Elena and Luke, you record things, right? And the recording of a conversation sort of crystallizes a conversation. It makes it more dynamic and crystalline. It's catalytic to record. So, you know, I hope in some ways that this film encourages people to say to themselves, it's not too late, even if someone that they love is already dead. There are still people who knew them, who you can talk to, who you can record with. It's not too late to imagine yourself no longer alive and who might miss you or feel in pain when you are gone. So, you know, that feeling we have of it's all too late. It's not too late for this planet. It's not too late for this country to really face the pain of who we are.
You have children yourself, Kirsten. If one of them came to you in about 30 years with the same idea for a project, would you be into that?
Wouldn't that be awesome if I had that child? I mean, I think before making this movie, I would have said definitely not. But, you know, just because, you know, I think we all care deeply about our image in the world, our legacy. But our legacy lives in other people and we don't know what it is. And the fact is, you know, when I was making Camera Person, I thought I was making it about the past. And then this woman in Bosnia says to me, you know, oh, you're making this so your children will see who you were. And in this case also, I consciously thought I'm making this movie, my children will know who my father was. But in fact, this movie is also evidence of who I am and who I was for the future in which I will not be.
This movie is just so powerful, and it really takes the fear out of a lot of things that I think we walk around afraid of, you know, in our lives. And so it's just, and it's super funny,
too.
So great job, Kirsten. This is a really, really important piece of filmmaking.
Thank you all so much.
That was Kirsten Johnson right here on Live Wire. Her really incredible film. I highly recommend everyone go check this out. Dick Johnson is Dead is available on Netflix right now. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Elena Passarella. We have to take a very quick break, but don't go anywhere because we'll be back with more LiveWire. LiveWire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. And they make one-of-a-kind handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LiveWire, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to LiveWire from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. You ready to hear some music, Elena?
Oh, I can't wait.
This is actually really, really good this week. I'm super excited we were able to get this person on. She rose to fame during her 2 years as a cellist as part of the Grammy Award-winning African-American string band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, which are amazing. Then she struck out on her own, and her solo debut album, Very Colored Songs, a tribute to Langston Hughes, is actually being re-released this year on Smithsonian Folkways, and we are going to hear from some of that now. Joining us all the way from New Orleans, Layla McCalla, welcome to Livewire.
Thanks for having me.
This album is amazing. I feel remiss that I didn't know about it back when it was originally released, but I'm super excited that Smithsonian Folkways is putting it back out because it is a gem.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, it feels good.
I mean, when you released it in 2014, did you have a sense that it would have a kind of a second life like this? I feel like it's hitting a lot of people's radar for the first time right now.
Yeah, I mean, I always felt that the poems themselves were timeless, and I knew that would carry the songs, you know. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize maybe was where this album would take me in my life. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to kind of reconnect with the reasons why I started putting out records, because this is my first album. And, you know, it was a big sort of coming into myself as an artist and kind of claiming that about myself.
Was there a particular piece of work by Langston Hughes that kind of sparked in your imagination the idea for this record?
Yeah, I would say it's the song Heart of Gold, which is the song that opens the record. Yeah, that's the song that I think I first really heard music, you know, when I was reading this poem. Mm-hmm. And so it's been interesting to think about that, because the deeper I go into his work, and, you know, I hear music in a lot of his work. It doesn't feel exclusive to the poems that are represented on this album, but I did a show. It was like an album release show, and I've been performing the songs for so many years now, and I tried to, you know, stay true to the order of the songs on the album. And even that was kind of like, wow, my head was just in such a different place when I first assembled these songs. I'm like, wow, I had a really specific idea of the story I was trying to tell, that, and that story has really changed. Mm-hmm. So it's been interesting to just think about, you know, how your mind changes, but then the songs kind of are still true to some part of your journey, you know?
That's got to be really interesting, because the first time you approach the album, you're working with a text that's 60 years old. And now when you reapproach the album, there's a new older text and it's yours. Like you're your own archive now.
Right. I'm like, wow, I used to really be like wanting to be like super creative about songwriting, you know, not that I'm not, but I'm like, God, it's so nice to connect with that sort of beginner's mind.
Yeah.
Cool. I guess that's the benefit of this COVID reality, is like, we all have to kind of go back to the beginning of something.
Yeah.
Right. It's sort of like first thought, best thought.
Right. You know? Totally. Totally.
Well, what song are we going to hear today?
So I'm going to play a song for you. This one's called Song for a Dark Girl. This was comes from a poem written by Langston Hughes in 1927. Mm. And I find that the words to this song really seem to apply to our world today.
Yeah. All right. This is Layla McCalla here on Livewire.
Way down south in Dixie, break the heart of me. They hung my black young lover to a crossroads tree. Way down south in Dixie, Bruce's body high in the air. I asked the white Lord Jesus, what was the use of prayer? Way down south in Dixie, break the heart of me. Love is a naked shadow
on an ugly naked tree. Way down south in Dixie, break the heart of me. They hung my black young lover to a crossroads tree. Way down south in Dixie, bruised body high in the air. I asked the white Lord Jesus, what was the use of prayer? Way down south in Dixie, break the heart of me. Love is a naked shadow on an ugly naked tree. Love is a naked shadow on an ugly naked tree. Love is a naked shadow on an ugly naked tree.
Layla McCalla, right here on LiveWire. Thank you so much. Woo. The album Varicolored Songs has been re-released by Smithsonian Folkways, and it is available now. It's a tribute in part to the poetry of Langston Hughes. Layla, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, before we get out of here, a little preview of next week's show. It's going to be a really good one you don't want to miss. We're going to chat with Daisy Hernandez about her new book, The Kissing Bug, which looks at something called the kissing bug disease. The book really is about how poverty and racism and public policies have all played a role in the spread of this disease and who gets affected by it mostly. Then we are going to talk to the one, the only Wayne Coyne from The Flaming Lips, live and direct from his compound in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. We talked to him about what it's like going back on the road after the pandemic. And we're going to hear some music from Broadway star, you may know him from Hamilton, Joshua Henry. Plus, of course, we're going to be looking to get your answers to our listener question, which is what next week, Elena?
What are you excited to get back to doing? I know my answer. Writing on the board. I can't wait to write on the board again.
In class, like IRL, with students sitting there, and you get to write things on the board.
Yes, I can't wait.
All right, if you want to send in your thoughts on that question, please do submit it by way of Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. We are at LiveWire Radio. I'm excited to us getting back to doing these shows in front of a live crowd.
Oh, heck fire, yeah.
Which is going to be happening starting in September. So if you're hearing this and you want to get tickets, you can head on over to our website for that. All right, that's going to do it for our show this week. A huge thanks to our guests, Lindy West, Kirsten Johnson, and Layla McCalla. LiveWire is brought to you in part by Alaska Airlines.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer. Heather D. Michelle is our executive director. Tim Harkins is our production director. Our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko. Our assistant editor is Trey Hester. And Jennifer Vo is our social media manager. Our music is composed by A. Walker Spring. Molly Pettit is our technical director and mixer.
Additional funding provided by the Oregon Cultural Trust and the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. LiveWire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we'd like to thank member Heidi Sobel of Portland, Oregon. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, visit livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank for Elena Passarello and the whole LiveWire crew. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week. Wouldn't it be amazing to have a piping hot episode of LiveWire delivered right to your heart and ears each week? Well, guess what? That can happen when you subscribe to the LiveWire podcast feed and you'll get the joy of surprising conversation every week. So go ahead and do it. It's super easy. You click on the button at the top of your podcast app and bam, you are LiveWire subscribed. And if you're still, you know, feeling the love, if you're enjoying the show, hey, maybe you could hook us up and leave us a quick review. That'll help more people find out about LiveWire. And thank you.